Good evening, everyone. Thanks for being with us. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. The topic tonight, reincarnation, past lives. Is this something that is appropriate for science to investigate? Can it be proven one way or another beyond reasonable doubt? When we come back, my guest, Paul Von Ward, will discuss some of the most compelling cases that he's investigated, and we'll be opening up the phone lines a little bit later with your questions as well. Stay with us for more Coast to Coast AM. Paul Von Ward, my guest tonight, talking about the scientific investigation of reincarnation. Paul, the last time you were here, I know we went over some cases, and I recall speaking about the painter Gauguin. I wanted to know if you could update us on that, sort of give us the characteristics. Instead of going through a laundry list of the factors you look for, maybe explain those factors in the context of some examples. Start with Gauguin and give us an update on where that case stands.
Okay, we can start there. This is the case of Peter Tekamp, a present-day artist who started his own self-discovery of a past life connection based on other people telling him when they knew his personality and his artwork and so on. His wife, a business colleague, another person that he met said, you know, you're something like Paul Gauguin, and he laughed about it and finally thought he ought to take a look at the history of this artist Gauguin, because he had never actually paid much attention to his paintings in his own lifetime this time around. He began to find all kinds of similarities, and he met a woman who turned out to be what we think is probably his wife as his incarnation during the time of Paul Gauguin. Anyhow, this person and he started doing research, looking at pictures of Gauguin, comparing themselves to their own pictures, found a great resemblance of physical features, and then he began to dig into the biographies and the historical accounts of their personalities and behaviors, and found that they had personality traits very, very similar. Gauguin was a vagabond traveling around the world. This guy, Peter Tekamp, is exactly the same kind of person. They had similar relationships with their spouses and children, similar problems with alcohol and other personal habits. They had suicidal episodes in their lives. All of these personality traits and talents. And they were discovered by the person that I mentioned just earlier, Walter Simkew, who was the first researcher to talk to them about their research, and he was very confirming of their hypothesis about their possible previous past lives. And a little bit later on, I got involved with them and did some more detailed research and evaluation on their cases. And I think several of us in this area of reincarnation research feel that this is one of the strongest cases that we have in the artist area.
Is there a way to grade it? I mean, you know, you have your list of factors that are relevant here. Is there a way to grade this? Is it a B plus or a C minus or a number?
Well, we haven't been able to develop a scale, you know, from 1 to 10 and say this is the percentage that you get an A for and this is the percentage you get a B for, because we're still not sure that we have all of the parameters that, you know, that are involved. It's still an evolving a model of what we call the soul genome or psychoplasm, but I would say in this case, you know, it's a B plus or an A minus case, because it has the biometrics, that is the physical genotype characteristics of body type and facial features and so on, and more importantly, it has a cluster of traits that are related to the painting
Yeah, I was going to ask you, have you had him do a painting and then take it to an art expert and say, hey, how does this compare to Gauguin?
Yeah, actually, Walter Simkiw was the first one to ask him to do that. And he, in a very short time, he had never painted like Gauguin before in his painting. But when he sat down and tried to do it, he came up with very, very credible copies are very closely resembling portraits and other pictures that he had never done until he tried to do drawing on this, what he might think of as a latent talent from the Gauguin lifetime.
Well, did he do, was he basically an impressionist, or did he, if not exactly like Gauguin, was he in that style?
Well, generally in that style, but what was interesting about the paintings that he did to try to copy Gauguin, you know, people who copy famous paintings do training for years in order to get the brush strokes and the shading and have these techniques that are learned. It appears that Peter Tekamp had already inherent in his skill those specific strokes and techniques. And one of the things that was interesting, as he discovered himself, is that Gauguin had actually painted pictures of himself in very small places on his portraits or other scenes, and Peter had been doing that from the beginning in his own painting style. So this was a sort of an idiosyncratic habit that both of them had. So what we have in this case is a very long list of these similarities that I usually talk about the comparison of a past life and a present life. The comparison of them, the process we use is something like people who study twins, you know, that are identical twins, and one is taken away and lives in another part of the country. And when they get to be an adult, the psychologist who studied them say, you know, there's 85% chance that the behaviors of these two people who've been separated all their lives are based on the same DNA. So this is a sort of technique to rate how much influence the DNA had on these two twins. Well, I think what we're talking about here is a past life, which is, don't think of it as the first life, because it's the soul genome that has had many lifetimes developing itself. So the pictures that we have, the biographies we have of Gauguin and Tekamp are so comparable that we would say, in this other context of the twin studies, that these are like two identical twins. And all of these features that we now use, looking at twins living in, of course, the same time, same lifetime.
Let me ask you about twins. Yeah, is there a connection, a soul connection between twins today? Is that part of your research, or I'm just reaching on that? I would wonder if they're splitting a soul, or if there's if they're twins, that must mean they're part of the traveling soul family kind of a thing, or do you know?
Well, frankly, we don't have enough twin cases to make any sort of conclusion about that. I would say that one of the things that's getting more complex as we get more cases, we are finding that there seems to be a lot of bleed through among people in this, what we mentioned earlier, as a soul cohort. It seems that as people live and work and interact with each other in different lifetimes, or at least what we think are different lifetimes as a group, they began to share a lot of, as would happen, you know, just in our own family or our community, share a lot of attitudes and behaviors and habits and so on that get carried forward from different lifetimes. And how that happens is a mystery, because it's pretty easy to develop a model of a soul genome if you're talking about one person reincarnating in the next lifetime as that same integral personality, and a third lifetime, and so on. But you mentioned the term soul splits. This is a concept that is being tossed around in the reincarnation community, that at some point in time, it appears that people are so closely matched that they must have shared the same lifetime at some time in the past. And this gets us into the sort of murky area of how does the soul genome, how does the psychoplasm get entangled with the fetus in a new lifetime to have the kind of influence on the young person who results from that fetus? How does the psychoplasm carry these physical and mental and emotional and personality trait factors?
What are those things imprinted on that they can be transferred?
Well, I mean, it's speculation at this point, because the more we get into genetics, you know, the less we know about what actually influences the outcome. You know, about 15, 20 years ago, we thought one gene would have a clear impact on the body or the health or the talents or the abilities of the new child. What we now know is that there are no such direct connections, because we've got different genes playing different roles, and now we have the whole epigenome, the so-called junk DNA, obviously playing a role in this. And now, even in the last year or two, we're discovering that environmental influences and even our own conscious intentions can have an effect on how the genome expresses itself. And so we can't pin down, you know, simple, these 10 genes are responsible for these 10 characteristics. And so what we're thinking about at this point is that there has to be some sort of energetic field that is more ephemeral, I guess is a good word to use. In other words, it's not such a tight package. It's more interactive with all other packages of DNA. So this is, I thought when I was starting this project about 5 or 6 years ago, that we're going to be able to, you know, make these DNA matches. We're going to make these other matches very clearly. But just like we're doing in neuroscience today, I mean, we're not able to pinpoint in the brain the center for so many things. They seem to be spread out throughout the brain. Well, this whole idea of the soul seems to be not only spread out from one lifetime to another, but among different people. So I'm a little bit at this point both excited and frustrated by the fact that we haven't been able to nail down 10 factors that are easily measured to show from one lifetime to the next.
Tell me this, Paul, with this case of Gauguin that we've been talking about, so many similarities, would he be a candidate for a hypnotic regression? I know from UFO abduction research, there are a lot of pitfalls with this. A lot of questions get raised. It can be manipulated. I don't know how you feel about using that as a tool. I suppose you wouldn't want to rule it out entirely if it could be useful in some ways, but would say after everything else seems to gel, would you be willing to test him through that and see where it leads, or is there too great a risk of contaminating the whole thing?
Well, starting on the other end, where we have cases that started with past life regression, we have been able to determine just from listening to the tapes and listening to the debriefings of both the hypnotist and the subject, that there is a lot of possibility for contamination. In other words, when you go into a session with an a priori assumption about the outcome, then we tend to make that happen. And one of the things that neuroscience is helping us to do is to understand the volatility, the fungibility of memories. I mean, we now know that we can't hold the exact memory from one moment to the other. Every time we pull a memory up out of our memory banks, the very act of pulling it up makes a change. I think we've done so much work with Peter Tekamp and his partner, Michel Moshe, that it would be almost impossible to get a new idea that was totally independent of their experience of all this research up to this point. It's a long answer, but that's where I would come down.
I do want to get into some other cases, other best cases. One of the ones that you mentioned on your website, the reincarnationexperiment.org, or just reincarnationexperiment.org, is that of Klaus von Stauffenberg. We have about 2 minutes before the break, but can you give me the thumbnail sketch of what's going on with that one?
Yeah, that's a very interesting case. Now, that case started with one of these hypnotic sessions that we were talking about, which has some questions about it. But he also had some other personal experiences and memories that he thinks are important, and he had some confirmation from channel source. Enough sources to have a variety of clues made this a very interesting case to delve into and to use our factor model to evaluate it. And it's still elusive, but it is a very strong case. It has a possibility that it may be one of these soul cohort cases, but we've had to sort of stop on the case at this point because the person has experienced what we were talking about earlier, public reaction, which is, not positive for...
So the story got out about who he might be.
Well, yeah, and he's had some difficulties with employment and some other social situations in Germany.
Oh. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to get a little bit more into that case as well as go into the case that may be a reincarnation of Marie Antoinette, and then later tell me how I might be able to investigate this if I want to know if I had a past life or our listeners had a past life. Stay with us, everyone. Our conversation with Paul von Ward continues. So here's one to get your head around. We're talking about past lives, reincarnation. As we know, quantum physicists, cosmologists, are looking at time and whether time is linear, whereas we think that time, what's happening now is the present and what happens next is the future. Maybe it doesn't work that way. So in discussing past lives, could it be that the life you have now is the one that's on the road to what somebody might call your past life, if you know what I mean. Paul Von Ward is my guest. We'll ask him if he can get his head around that, and maybe ask him whether he's had past life experiences, information that he considers to be fairly reliable, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Paul Von Ward, we were talking before the break about this guy who may or may not have be the reincarnation of Klaus von Stauffenberg. I guess the idea first popped up during a regression session. What is it about that case, though, that's compelling beyond what he learned under hypnosis?
Well, I think some of the physical features that he has experienced are quite compelling. We know that Klaus von Stauffenberg, of course, was wounded in the war and lost an eye and part of his hand and arm, and these sorts of wounds are so specific in terms of where they were on the body and so on, that the subject at this point has had a history of physical, obviously he wasn't born with these amputated, as has been a case that Ian Stevenson had published about 20 years or so ago. But his health in terms of his back, in terms of his limbs, have matched the places on Stauffenberg's body. So that suggests some phenotype or genotype influence there. Also, some of his personality traits in terms of his, one might say, foolhardiness or willingness to take on dangerous tasks and show a great deal of courage. This is one of the traits that this person has. In fact, I said to him that his courage to even pursue such a case in Germany, where Klaus von Stauffenberg is such a renowned figure and both liked and admired, and also on the other side not very well liked. So his personality is very, very strong in that direction.
You mean the fact that he would have the courage to come forward and say this, knowing he's going to be ridiculed, is very von Stauffenberg like.
It sure is, because Stauffenberg, was came from an aristocratic family, but really stood out in terms of his breaking with the establishment, his involvement in a circle that was taking a very different position on the future of Germany, and so on. These kinds of personality traits are very strong, and the persistence of this person in trying to deal with this problem, because he sees it as sort of a damned if he does and damned if he doesn't, because if he claims it, the Stauffenberg family members of the current descendants of Stauffenberg have a very negative attitude about that.
Oh, I'll bet. Yeah.
And also, he has worked with a number of researchers in Germany as well as myself, and has been encouraged, to at least share the information with the public. And he can't do that because he has his own life in the present time, having to support himself and to have responsible positions in Germany, and the word has gotten around, and he has some suspicions that that is sort of spoiling his opportunities. It's a case in process, as I would describe it. We're following it and going to keep evaluating sort of what happens with him.
Tell me this: you ever had a case where it's a fairly well-known person like von Stauffenberg, he comes back, or somebody makes the claim that he is a reincarnation of X, Y, or Z, and that person meets the descendants or the family of the person he's supposedly reincarnated as and convinces them that he or she is the real deal?
Well, there is a published account of this. There's a woman named Barbara Carlin from Sweden who is the apparent reincarnation of Anna Frank, Anne Frank. And she, after publishing her case and it becoming something of a tempest in a teapot, with a lot of people once again taking a very negative attitude that somebody would claim to be the reincarnation of Anne Frank. But it so happens that a cousin of Anne Frank's, who is still alive, met Barbara and had a very positive encounter with her, and he hugged her and said, you know, you seem to be, you know, the reincarnation of Anne Frank. So that, but the rest of the family, I must hasten to add, was very negative about it. But at least in this case, there was some confirmation. And there was also some confirmation for her by people who also knew Anne Frank in her period of having the family hiding away from the Nazis.
So tell me this.
Collaboration.
Okay. Marie Antoinette, give me a thumbnail sketch of that case that is also on your website, mentioned on your website.
Yeah, this is a fascinating case. Once again, it's anonymous, but one of my collaborators in the States, who is a French woman who is an intuitive and works with people in past life regressions and other counseling activities, had met this person who thought she was the reincarnation of Marie Antoinette, and my colleague, whose first name is Marie, Marie Rabel, who lives in the Los Angeles area as an active counselor and therapist there. She worked through this person's life, gathering a lot of information about her personality and her life path, if you please, and compared those factors to all of it. You know, we have so much information on someone like Marie Antoinette that it's easy to make these kinds of comparisons. But then she got the reincarnation experiment involved in it, and we developed the biometrics and the personality factors and very, very high correspondences between those two lifetimes. So my colleague, Maria Leix, has helped this anonymous subject to actually write a fictional book about this, and it's about to come out in France in French and hopefully in English in the next year or so, hopefully, to get that story out, because it's not only the case of Marie Antoinette as a person being reincarnated, but this person has been identifying other members of that era.
Who are around now? Meaning
who are around now, and still in France, and some in the States, some in Canada, and it's a fascinating case in terms of looking at a cohort, because some of them have had personal relationships in this lifetime. Similar to the lifetime during the French Revolution, including some of the children that were involved.
I would imagine the human dynamics of that, as you've got the reincarnation of Marie Antoinette, allegedly contact somebody who's the reincarnation, she says is the reincarnation of King Louis or something, and they don't necessarily know each other. Hey, by the way, you were King Louis and you were my husband in a previous life. That must be really interesting. Little moment of truth.
Some of these revelations, if you please, have caused some further alienation in some of these relationships. In other cases, it has actually helped people resolve some conflicts among themselves. And so it's very interesting to to throw this hypothesis in the middle of a group of people who've had no relationships before as a group, but have had individual relationships, and now they're beginning to see themselves as part of a cohort. And it involves some young people and some older people. It involves a young boy who's dying from an incurable disease, and his father's present wife about to have a baby that may be connected to the one who is dying. This is a fascinating, jigsaw puzzle of possible relationships.
What about you, Paul? Have you explored your own past lives?
Well, a little bit. Early on, some years ago, I had some past life regression sessions, and I had some channeled material from different sources, and several things came out sort of of a general nature that seemed to make sense to me. Looking at sort of a checkered career that I've had in this lifetime that you mentioned in the introduction early on, I've done a number of different career paths only for a short time. And some of those activities might be better explained by a past life experience than by rational decision making in this lifetime. To me, it's hard for me as a researcher to judge the material about myself. That's obviously quite contaminated. I've been playing with one lifetime that actually was an intuitive hit by Marie-Alex Ravel, the person that I mentioned who's working on the Marie Antoinette case with me.
And the one hit, is it a name we might recognize?
It's not a name that you would recognize. It was a psychologist who lived in Switzerland in the late 19th and early 20th century named Theodor Flournoy. And what struck me when she suggested, Paul, I think you ought to look into this, because he was a psychologist who was somewhat like I am today, always interested in looking at the paranormal. He did a good bit of research in the 1890s and early 19-teens, looking at psychics and people who were channels and so on in Switzerland. He, once again, was somewhat like I am, open but a little skeptical and testing. And I compared some of his writing. He wrote a book, he wrote two or three books, but one about a particular case. And it strikes me that I'm sort of repeating those same patterns in my own writing these days and various books that I've written. So, from that sort of perspective of personality, intellect, area of vocational interest, it seems like a reasonable fit, but the biometrics don't seem to fit in that case. And I'm playing with it, but I'm not going to run a flag up the pole and declare.
I mentioned this between breaks, the idea of time not necessarily being linear, that what is the future doesn't necessarily follow the present, and that it moves in both directions, which a lot of quantum physicists think is entirely possible. Have you explored that as a way of suggesting that maybe the life we have now is actually comes before what we would call a past life?
Well, I've thought about it, and I must say that that sort of concept is antithetical to the general notion that I've been working with in terms of reincarnation, which is that reincarnation is a natural phenomenon that the universe needs in terms of preserving the knowledge and experience that humans and other beings have. If we are an evolving, self-learning universe, which is I've spent a number of years working on that cosmology model and published that in my book, Our Solarian Legacy. And I think the evidence suggests that it is an unfolding. I mean, from our study of the universe itself, it's a progressive trajectory of the universe developing into greater complexity, experimentation, and things that don't work pass out of the picture, and things that do work continue to develop in a linear direction. So the model of reincarnation that is one of a self-developing soul genome or psychoplasm would be inconsistent with going in both directions.
Okay. Well, you know, I have a lot of questions about how it works, and maybe some of this is unknowable, even if you've got a really solid case that's a B-plus or better. You know, how it works. Do we choose our next incarnation? Is it a factor of we're not really choosing it? It's more of a factor of the karma we've built up along the way. Someone like Hitler, does he get to come back? And if so, as who or as what? Do you have all that stuff worked out?
I have none of it worked out.
Oh, come
out.
On. Give me the answers right now. I'm just kidding.
I have one case of a person who thinks he's Hitler reincarnated. But I don't think he is. I think that's a case of mental instability. But no, I don't think we have it figured out. I think that, you know, going back to the early Buddhist thought about this, and their concept was that we do have some degrees of freedom and choice. That is, if the soul genome is still held together as an integral bundle of consciousness after death, that it has the opportunity to make some choices about possible parents for the next go-around. And so I would say that if consciousness is, as we conceive it at this point in time, that there are degrees of freedom. There is some choice. There is some, in other words, it's not you don't have 360 degrees of freedom, but you have, you know, 30 degrees of freedom in terms of the choices you make. It's just that none of us have total free will, but we have some degrees of free will.
I know that one of the questions that always comes up in a discussion of reincarnation, and maybe I'll just let the listeners, when we open up the phone lines, get into this, is about the number of souls that are floating around out there. How it somehow doesn't jive. We've got too many billions of people here now. Where did all these souls come from? Where were they just floating around before? We'll get into that, open up the phone lines, maybe talk about some cases that I find most compelling in this area, and that's where these young kids will speak a foreign language and they've never had any experience with it before, suggesting that they lived somewhere else in another country than their current incarnation. Much more to come with my guest, Paul Vaughn Ward, discussing reincarnation, scientific research of past lives. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM.